with implementation.
Yes, agenda paper 12A. So in November 2016, the Interpretations Committee discussed a submission regarding the application of IFRS 9. The submitter asked whether an entity recognizes a gain or loss when a financial liability is modified or exchanged, and that modification or exchange does not result in the derecognition of the financial liability. The two possible views identified by the submitter are reproduced in paragraph 6 of the agenda paper. Under view 1, an entity re-estimates the contractual cash flows but does not change the original effective interest rate. Any adjustment to the carrying amount of the financial liability is then recognized as a gain or loss. Under view 2, an entity does not recognize a gain or loss at the modification date. Instead, it recalculates the EIR as well as re-estimating the contractual cash flows. As a result, the entity amortizes any gain or loss over the remaining term of the modified liability. The Interpretations Committee supported view 1. It concluded that paragraph B546 of IFRS 9 applies to all revisions of estimated payments or receipts, including changes in cash flows arising from modifications or exchanges. It noted that this is consistent with the requirements in paragraph 543 of IFRS 9 relating to modifications of financial assets and the definition of amortized cost in IFRS 9. In addition, the financial liability continues to be accounted for as the same liability if it is not derecognized. The Interpretations Committee tentatively decided to develop a draft interpretation, which would explain the accounting for such modifications and exchanges. The staff had recommended an agenda decision on the grounds that the principles and requirements in IFRS 9 provide an adequate basis to enable an entity to account for modifications and exchanges of financial liabilities. However, the majority of Interpretations Committee members expressed concerns that a non-authoritative agenda decision would not give the matter enough prominence. In the light of the outreach responses regarding practice applying IAS 39, they were concerned that many entities would be unaware of the conclusions reached by the committee and thus unaware that they may need to change their existing accounting for such modifications when they first apply IFRS 9. The draft interpretation would specify the accounting for such modifications and exchanges, referring to the relevant requirements in IFRS 9. In accordance with paragraph 7.10 of the Due Process Handbook, we are asking you today whether you object to the release of a draft interpretation.
Oh. I must say that having read the paper, even to me, the text seemed crystal clear. Daryl.
We tried, Dick.
So I don't know whether I'm over-reading this, but this almost seems to make the agenda decision process at IFRIC redundant. Because it seems like we're saying that even if it is clear, the only way to make it clear to the people using or applying our financial standards is through an interpretation. And I'm a little bit concerned about what I think I'm reading here as being the precedent that we're setting. And it does suggest at the very least that if we do go ahead with this in the meantime in the background, we need to be developing another way to communicate with the market. Because, as I say, it just seems like everybody seems to be happy we don't need to do it, except they feel that we want to do it.
Not us.
It might help if we don't call these agenda decisions rejection letters. Rejection letters.
That's what we do, right?
Yeah. Yes, so they're called rejection.
First thing that people see is rejection. Oh, okay, don't bother.
Maybe it is then about saying that this committee has another type of outfit, which is an education type outfit.
Well, that's made
more broadly available.
Maybe a renaming of what they are already doing.
Yeah. That seems to be what was suggested in the paper in any case as the alternative.
Well, we're trying to sort of describe this type, you know, if you did this type of thing to an agenda decision, you'd obviously provide that education material. So we can call it, you can call that type of an agenda decision an educative agenda decision.
Yeah.
Much more positive than being a rejection note.
And another thing we are obviously going to do with the new website coming along as well is to try and make these types of educative agenda decisions much more prominent and much more easily accessible, and as Hans said, to kind of, you know, message it in the right way, because they do actually include, you know, detailed and I think very helpful, you know, education style materials, you know, whereas in the past they've just been viewed as sort of a no to anything.
So then perhaps to the question that you actually asked, and perhaps given this background as well, I am quite concerned about us doing something in this space because of the precedent that we're setting.
Steve.
I have the same view as Daryl. I can't read 5, 4, 6 to get any other answer. I mean, I've looked through all the other words in the standard, and now I got to the definition of a modification, gain or loss, and it does only refer to an asset, and maybe that should have also said liability, but 5, 4, 6 says asset and liability, and it's perfectly clear, and I just don't see how you could get to another interpretation of it. And to do an interpretation which for this, it's almost like you'd have to do an interpretation for every paragraph in the standard saying yes, we really did mean that.
Yes.
That's principle-based accounting, see?
I mean, I think saying that the rejection notice is educational, finding a way of making it more prominent is one. Maybe we need to look at some manual improvement on, you know, adding a word in. I don't know. I mean, is there something that we can do?
Certainly explore that, Steve.
To explore things that might help people read 5, 4, 6.
I sort of was joking before when I said I'm glad this has come forward to today, because I don't want another night not sleeping worrying about what to do on this, because I must say I'm so torn on this issue, because I chaired the interpretation committee meeting when we discussed it, and I can sort of see both sides. And I think if we start talking about changing the words in the standard, it might imply that it's not clear. And the tricky thing was the interpretations committee was very clear that they thought it was clear based on the words in the standard, right? So it's difficult, but I think if I read between the lines, I think it was partly about not enough prominence, which I think was what Marcus said, but I think what they're saying is they don't think that just using the words in this book they can affect the change that they're going to need to make in the market. And so they're looking for a change management tool, in a sense, and the more authoritative that is, I think the more they think they'll be able to affect the change that we're looking for, because they've all somehow convinced themselves of what the words already say. Now, that doesn't mean that I then say, therefore, because they want it, we should do it, because I do have significant reservations on the other side. And my reservations are twofold. One is that it's a bit weird going out with an interpretation that basically says, read paragraph A, B, and C, and therefore the answer is clearly this. It's sort of just pulling everything together and not really adding anything. And usually interpretations add something more. And I think coupled with that, what makes that particularly tricky, I think, in this case, is it won't be in place for the 1st of January 2018.
Yeah.
So we're going to create a perception that somehow maybe you could read the words differently when people are about to apply the standard and the interpretation wouldn't be available until a later date. So I think we've got a bit of a challenge in terms of messaging. I think the other challenge that we have, and the reason why I really am nervous about an interpretation, is that if you talk to people about how they got to a different meaning from the words, which I think are clear, it's because they had decided that it wasn't appropriate to book gains and losses in these circumstances. And we had a little bit of a discussion at the Interpretations Committee from memory, yeah, mm-hmm. about why it would be appropriate to book gains and losses because I've modified something if it wasn't such a big deal that it caused derecognition. And it's very clear in IFRS 9 that we think whenever you change the contractual cash flows or change the estimates of the cash flows, timing, etc., that we expect there to be a modification gain or loss. But somehow people have decided that for them it only makes sense to book gains and losses if the change was so significant it would have triggered a derecognition event.
But they accept it for the assets, that's what I don't
only because
understand.
We've made it much more clear. So you can't avoid it because we've said in black and white a whole paragraph on exactly what it means for assets. But the only reason we did that was we wanted it to be very clear what affected the gross carrying amount versus what affected the impairment line. But they're using that as a distinction. And I think that the risk we're going to have if we send out an interpretation, even if the interpretation is just saying because of A, B and C, of course the answer is this, all of the people who think that the accounting should be different are going to write in saying we should change the accounting. And I think coupled with the timing, it's going to create uncertainty around what the words in 9 mean today.
But surely, so the accounting firms are represented on IFRIC, so they all think it's clear. So how could this possibly still happen in practice?
Because some of them have reached official positions that say that because it's not a derecognition event, it's not appropriate to book gains and losses.
No, but the accounting firms who agree that our texts are clear should then stop it, no?
Yeah.
Or the auditor should not allow that.
They said at the meeting they think it will be difficult to stop it unless we give them something else to work with.
That's the whole purpose of Hans. And as Sue said, what is the reason?
The question is, what's the something?
My God. Mary.
Why am I apparently naive about the power of the audit firms?
I'm not going to touch that question. It was not in the staff paper.
for the you don't have to vote on that.
Right.
Okay.
I also have a lot of concern, not about an interpretation going forward for the reasons that others have raised already about this one. And I think we have to think, and maybe this is time when it's better to be an impolite and abrupt American than it is to be a more discreet, non-confrontational diplomat, because to me the we need greater prominence than you would get in an agenda decision is not acceptable as a reason for going to an interpretation. The need for prominence doesn't work, and I have a feeling that that's a polite excuse given for we need something more to justify a change in practice, etc., and it's the change management issue. So we can talk all we want about greater prominence for the educative piece of agenda decisions, etc., but I think you have to move to something that's due process to give greater prominence is not just wrong for this issue, it's the wrong message, and it also, in another way, trains people to use the process to get forgiveness for past sins. So I think it trains the wrong behavior generically. Now, I think the staff has pointed out in this paper that many of the requirements in this area were carried forward from IS 39 to IFRS 9, and that may be a particular rock and hard place that people find themselves in, both preparers and auditors and maybe regulators as well. If we read it this way, permitted it to be read that way, did not object to it being read that way in the past, why would we change when it's carried forward into a new standard? And I think maybe we all have to use the transition to a new standard and reading everything in the context of a new standard as being the pivot point to say so you explained why the focus was on assets in the context of IFRS 9 in terms of distinguishing the two pieces and why it was only a discussion about assets, distinguishing the impairment part from the modification part. But maybe we need to make some extra draw attention to this, explain how putting this in the context of IFRS 9, not overreading the discussion, why the discussion was focused on assets, et cetera, and this highlights what our expectations are for the application of IFRS 9.
We were very careful at the Interpretations Committee to focus on IFRS 9, and the reason why I think that's appropriate is because we do have extra bars hummed, if you like, about how the mechanics worked for assets because of the link with impairment. It is a new piece of the jigsaw, if you like, for the people who didn't get it before. So I think it is fair to make a distinction between the old practice and IFRS 9, but equally I think it's really important we get people off on the right foot for IFRS 9. It's a good opportunity.
Yeah. And I think it fed into the Interpretations Committee conclusions as well. So they're very much those sort of extra words, in a sense, in IFRS 9 help the Interpretations Committee reach its conclusions.
I mean, we can take actions to try and accomplish the give more prominence to this item in some of the comments, speeches, conference, etc. But I don't think that was the underlying reason.
So there seems to be a conclusion that interpretation is not desirable.
I think so.
But the greater prominence issue, we're going to...
We'll have to think of something else strategically from the start.
So Henry...
About how we help with change management.
Yeah.
If we want to rename, for example, these agenda decisions, is that something we could just do?
Certainly put an adjective in front of it without having to change any process, I would have thought, because, so I think we can easily call them educative agenda decisions without a change in process, I'm sure. We want to go further.
But I think we need to do some extra things. I think we have to do webcasts.
I was just thinking a webcast would be a logical thing to do
on this particular
one, okay. given the history of it so far.
Given the history, Hans, and also given where the position is coming in practice, and the implication of this when it comes to measurement in EIR, this doesn't have a small impact. So I think we have to think of how we push that agenda rejection, even the renamed one, with some additional activities on that. Could be webcast, could be something, as Steve said, an annual improvement or something, which we can look at the definitions. But yes, we most probably should explore this and have another discussion with you.
Meet the spirit of the recommendation, but we stick to an agenda decision. There you go.
I support not to go to interpretation.
Why we could have
and my question is slightly different from the economic step back view. The staff already said the interpretation committee split, and there's some push from the regulator. So is there any economic reason
for
them?
No admission regulator.
So not on this issue. Not on this issue.
There wasn't any particular sort of push from regulator or anything to do with this issue.
Okay. No. Is there an economic reason, for example, because such things happen normally, people will not see consequence of their financial statement, either from positive or negative side. Negative side means because of the amendment of the contract, it will result in huge loss, And therefore, as a result, the company, would not like to see immediate effect on it. And it is possible if such a modification is driven by a regulator, they also don't want to see the immediate effect. This is why, I have some kind of, the concern. And the other side is, from a regulatory point of view, if you make intentionally, for economic reason, to make such amendments, will create, immediate, huge profit. Therefore, the regulator may say, no, you should not have the immediate. So is there any such kind of economic reason, or totally not? I personally, as a former regulator, I have a feeling there must be something behind. Otherwise, the principle is so clear, and we have, general principles in the conceptual framework. Why still people want to interpret differently, want to...
Behind the motivation that goes back to the long history of it, what has been there, and under 39, and there was an IGC before that, I think fundamentally what we are saying, you must look at it, if there's a substantial modification, we have a derecognition which will capture those gains and losses. That's a very different issue. This is a question of whether I've changed my estimates or there's a modification of the contractual terms, and what is that accounting? And what IFRS 9 makes it very clear that your effective interest rate doesn't change.
I want to get clarification about,
I think for me, where I think it comes from, Weiguo, is that when we talk about things being measured at amortized cost, based on all of the discussions we had over the whole development of IFRS 9, we were always talking very specifically about a measurement that was a present value of cash flows, and it was a cost measurement because it had a fixed effective interest rate. But I think we still have people who hear the cost bit. And so as long as the loan is on the books at the principal amount, in their mind, they think it's okay to spread the other bits. Whereas we're thinking of a present value concept. And I think that's where we still have a little bit of a disconnect between what we've written and what people understand. And that's why I think it is worth maybe looking at doing things like webcasts, etc., just to explain how that logic works. Because for me, I think that's the missing piece that we have in the puzzle at the moment. And I think if we stood up and explained why we think it makes sense, because of our notion and definition of amortized costs, that whether you've got a change in estimate that's caused because you think the prepayment timing's different, or whether it's because you've actually changed the contractual cash flows, the outcome should in both cases be a modification gain or loss, I think that will help people understand when they read the standard. And I think,
as Sue described, it would be relatively easier for us to, you know, to educate people and change people's mind. I fully agree with you. But if there are some economic reason, then it's relatively difficult, particularly in a particular environment condition. For example, the economic situation no good, and then some kind of national, you know, regulatory push, then become difficult. You know, if purely, you know, it understandability issues, it's okay.
Beryl. I just wanted to either clarify or possibly suggest in terms of the way this would go. So the IFRIC essentially has, I guess, three tools. They can issue an interpretation, they can recommend an annual improvement, or they can issue an agenda rejection. In terms of what we're thinking here, our problem is that agenda rejections, I think we're saying, don't carry enough prominence, they're not seen by enough people, they're not seen as perhaps sufficiently authoritative. In thinking about this particular problem and others like it, what we're looking for is more prominence. And I wouldn't want to see this as just an agenda rejection on steroids kind of thing. I think it does need to be separated out so people know this is something bigger and better, and be it education guidance or webinars or whatever. I think it does need to carry that additional label that the IFRIC has identified a need for educational support.
Martin.
Yeah, I agree with what Daryl has said, because when I think this issue is caused by people think IFRS 9 is more or less dealing with financial assets and have not looked really at the liability side, and especially to this issue think, okay, because it was not really communicated that we change this for the liabilities. And therefore, I think people say maybe, okay, they can continue to do what they have done under IAS 39, and therefore, even if the words are clear, we need a kind of communication effort to make that clear, that this change also resulted from that.
We're certainly very happy to take that away. It's something, as I said, we've been thinking about already, and maybe this issue just emphasizes it even more, that maybe we need to try and distinguish this type of situation where we have sort of education material stuff and highlight it a lot more.
But, even though I support this idea, education or whatever, Daryl, I worry about the word you use, make it more authoritative, more prominent. Because if we will go this road, in the future, we have more and more push. Some people say that, wait a minute, we agree such a decision, but please, try to do more. Do you think we have this danger?
The problem here is, and you're right, authoritative might not be the best word for it, but I think what we are trying to do is certainly make it more prominent and certainly make it something that we want people, not just the people who are reading the minutes of the IFRIC, but actually people who go a step further than that. So we need something that makes sure we get it delivered to a greater audience.
Mary?
Just a comment about maybe trying to walk the talk ourselves. Daryl, when you were just talking about it, you referred several times to IFRIC rejection notices or agenda rejections. And I don't think they're actually called rejections, because the fundamental question, that the first question that they have to answer is, should the interpretation committee take something onto its agenda or recommend that we take something onto its agenda? A decision not to could be because they think there isn't an issue or that doesn't warrant it, but it could be because it's too big or across, you know, there. So it isn't a rejection of something as a non-issue. It's just it really is literally reporting a decision not to add something to its agenda. So I think we just have to refer to them, you know, discipline ourselves to call them agenda decisions, and then some of them will have extra education material with them. So I think it takes away some of the negative connotations of, you know, why were you so foolish to ask this question kind of thing.
Katrina and Henry are going to come up with something brilliant.
Yeah.
Anybody will understand?
We don't have, what we have is not bad now. We just don't call it by what they're actually called.
We just give bad names to good things. Françoise.
Well, I hesitated more than once with what I'm going to say, because I've thought this issue very true enough, probably. But I mean, here we are, we have an issue that will benefit from the transition requirements, implementation of FS9 in a while. And if the implementation team moves to relabeling the educational material that IFRIC can issue that helps clarify what the practice should be under an RFRS, I was wondering whether, and please take into account the fact that I have not analyzed this thoroughly, but I was wondering whether this educational material that is not authoritative but that helps understand IFRS better could be inserted and referred to in IS8 as a change in accounting policy. Because I think a lot of the tension around this educational material is the fact that, I mean, IFRS has not changed. I have a change to make because I find out that I was not having the right practice. So I fall into the category of a correction and an error. And that makes a lot of tension for everyone in the process. So when we have, in that case, a widespread practice of, in a way, not being compliant, I think we would probably help. So maybe it has a drawback of forgiveness for real errors, and that's why I mentioned that I have not thought this issue through enough. But maybe that's a way of alleviating the difficulty in the process.
Yeah. And it's such a good idea, Françoise, that it's actually something that we've been talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, we are thinking about whether we should do some of those things. And Hans, in terms of trying to start off assisting with the change management and helping the signalling to the market, I wonder whether, even though it wasn't the question in the paper, so I'm hesitating slightly, but I think it might be useful if the board could confirm this reading of IFRS 9 so we can refer to it specifically in update. Yes?
Okay.
I think it goes without saying, but I think it would be helpful to be able to say it.
All in favour?
One agrees.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Well, I think you can go back and take this message.
Agenda paper 12B. The objective of this session is to report to the board on the implementation question relating to IFRS 9. Since the last impairment transition resource group meeting in December 2015, no new submissions have been received. However, we have received one question from practice, which we think is worth providing some educational material on. The question is about the application is one subparagraph in the impairment section of IFRS 9, paragraph B5540C. The question is not about how to determine the expected life in general, but is specifically about how to limit the expected life on the basis of expected credit risk management actions. This paper reiterates the relevant requirements in IFRS 9 and the board's intention behind those requirements, as well as bringing together the relevant observations made by the ITG. This is not a decision-making paper. IFRS 9 requires expected losses, credit losses, to be measured over the expected life of financial instruments. The general requirement is such that the longest period to consider is the maximum contractual life. During the consultation period, some raised concerns about this requirement. and the board decided to provide an exception for a specific type of financial instrument. So the first step to take is to determine whether a financial instrument meets this scope. If it doesn't, the general requirement applies. If it does, then the entity determines the expected life that may be beyond the contractual life by applying paragraph B5540. We would like to point out that although the focus of the paper is on part C, entities should consider all three factors in paragraph A, B, as well as C. As a background, the question related to this paragraph was discussed in the December 2015 ITG meeting. The question asked back then was, if a bank performs periodic credit review, can the bank limit the expected life of the facility to the next credit review date? The ITG observed that it may be appropriate only if the credit review is followed by credit risk mitigation actions. Subsequently, an additional question arose, which is what this paper is addressing. What happens if the entity does take mitigation actions, but only on some of the facilities that increase in credit risk rather than all of them? Does the entity still limit the expected life of all facilities or only some of the facilities? As set out in the paper, when an entity expects to mitigate only some of the increases in credit risk, the entity reflects that extent of mitigation in determining the expected life. Consistent with the ITG discussion, when a credit review is not followed by any mitigation actions, the credit review does not limit the expected life, and the expected life of the facility is not limited on the basis of credit review. Similarly, if credit review is followed by some mitigation actions that demonstrates the credit review is effective in limiting the expected life of some facilities, but not all of them, it shall be considered accordingly. This is consistent with the objective of the requirements in paragraph B5540, which is to determine the period of credit risk exposure for which expected credit losses would not be mitigated by entities' normal credit risk management actions. The staff would like to proceed to provide some education material to support the implementation of IFRS 9 and would be very, very happy to take questions from the board. So, do you have any questions?
Good suggestion.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And it strikes me that this issue and the issue we just discussed are both implementation issues around IFRS 9, and it also, you know, even though they came in different sources, one to the Interpretation Committee and one to the ITG, and you know, maybe ask the FI team whether you think these could be combined in one webcast or if they attract different audiences or you know, people have slightly different concerns, because it seems also, I mean, it's helpful to have a paper that pulls together and summarizes the different consideration. But I wonder if also in terms of drawing attention to this and showing how things knit together, it would be worth including that if we were to do, let's say, a webcast about the issue we discussed in 12A and just package them together.
I'm happy to consider it, Mary, but the audience is very specialized and we have already done our CDs before on this. But yes, certainly, we didn't have the other option when we were looking at it, but we will have you consider.
Double feature.
Yeah. Special popcorn sales button on me.
All right. That brings us to the end, I believe, of today.
Yeah.
And I would like the board members to stay so that we can talk about something else.